Welcome to the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. I'm Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today we'll discuss a new study by Pellegrino et al. Titled Left Ventricular Remodeling in Twin Pregnancy, Non-Invasively Assessed Using Hemodynamic Forces and Pressure Volume Relation Analysis, Prospective Cohort Study. This article was published January 23, 2024. Joining us today are Associate Editor Dr. Amanda LeBlanc, author Dr. Pietro Modesti, and expert Dr. Alex Da Silva. Let's get started. Amanda?
Thanks, Kara. In this short report by Modesti et al., the authors prospectively investigated the pattern of intraventricular hemodynamic forces associated with left ventricular function and remodeling in women with uncomplicated twin pregnancy. What the authors found was that in twin pregnancy, hemodynamic forces misalignment in the first trimester precedes the slight temporary decrease in left ventricular systolic function in the second trimester. At the third trimester, a rightward shift of the end-diastolic pressure-volume relationship, or EDPVR, was associated with the realignment of hemodynamic forces and normalization of ventricular contractility indices. So, Pietro, can you break this down for us in simpler terms, please?
Yeah, thank you, Amanda. Well, we can say that twin pregnancy is an ideal condition for studying the physiological response to increased workload over time. Echocardiography is the ideal method because other invasive methods or radiology cannot be applied in pregnancy. Over time, the possibilities offered by echocardiography increased progressively. Because at an early stage, echocardiography made it possible to study morphological changes over the left ventricle. The increase in left ventricular volume during pregnancy, particularly in twin pregnancies, was in fact demonstrated many years ago. In a second phase, the introduction of Doppler methods made it possible to study more in detail functional changes by measuring longitudinal and circumferential strain and single beat volume pressure curves. Now, in this study, we welcome the third phase of echocardiographic evaluation, which allows the non-invasive studies of intraventricular pressure gradients, the hemodynamical forces, which guide blood movements within the heart and outside from the heart. And in the first trimester, no morphological changes of the left ventricle are yet detectable. No increase in chamber volume, no muscle hypertrophy at the moment. But the effects of volume loading are already evident with an increase in transversely directed intraventricular forces compared to the longitudinal one. In the second trimester, the hypertrophic response begins to be evident with an increase in left ventricular mass index. But at this stage, a slight reduction in systolic contractile function is detectable. It is marked by a reduction in longitudinal strain. Only in the third trimester is an improvement of the diastolic portion of pressure volume curves documented, with an improvement of the DP-DV ratio, with a shift of the pressure volume curve to the right. At this stage, the longitudinal strain and the intraventricular forces ratio both normalize.
I appreciate that, Pietro. I always like to ask the authors to frame the study for others. What really got this whole study started?
Yeah, started from two main points. The first one is the need to study the early stages of hypertrophy, and more precisely, the response of the left ventricle muscle to an increase in mechanical volume load and the relationship between morphological changes and contractile function. In the past year, this initial phase could only be studied with invasive technique or experimental surgery in animals, but this approach only allow the morphological aspects of adaptations to be assessed. Today, the early stage of hemodynamics overload can be studied by measuring changes in the orientation of intraventricular pressure gradients that are named as intraventricular hemodynamic forces. This is of great interest both for the early stage of heart failure and for the evaluation of ventricular response to training, for example, in athletes, not only in pregnancy. The second point of interest was the change in diastolic function response to an increase of volume load, because we know that there is wall stiffness and chamber stiffness. The first one in hypertension, the second one with different dimension of the ventricle. And chamber stiffness is specific, a characteristic of patients with small ventricles. We now know that the increase in chamber volume in a physiological condition, such as pregnancy, corresponds to an improvement in diastolic function.
So, Alex, you're an accomplished investigator that studies maternal obesity of cardiac dysfunction in the offspring. In your opinion, as the content expert for this study, what was the most interesting or, you know, something unique, something to highlight about this study to you?
Well, as I mentioned, there are two highlights that I'd like to point out about this study. One is the cleverness of the authors to use these hemodynamic forces early on in the development of pregnancy, of twin pregnancy, as a way to detect, you know, very minor, modest changes in cardiac function that they were able to observe at this early stage that corresponded with morphological adaptations early on and a reduction in the function by mid-pregnancy. I thought that was very interesting. The other aspect is that they found that there is this diastolic, I would say, adaptation that then helps normalize the internal forces in the heart and lead to a well physiological adaptation to increase in preload.
One of the more interesting aspects of the discussion is the use of ejection fraction in contemporary clinical practice to guide the use of therapies and interventions in heart failure. Pietro, you and your co-authors state that ejection fraction is not only affected by changes in contractility, but also by preload, afterload, heart rate, and ventricular geometry, and that ejection fraction is a poor prognostic indicator for dysfunctions with preserved ejection fraction, which comprises up to 50% of the heart failure population. So you all are essentially asking for alternatives or integrations to ejection fraction that need to be actively sought in the field. So Pietro and Alex, what do you foresee this playing out in the next few years or decade?
Well, this is a real point of interest for the clinician. The transfer of the possibilities offered by the new technologies into the clinical setting was very slow in recent years, and we still continue to talk about ejection fraction and to classify our failure as ejection fraction preserved or not preserved. The evaluation of strain and the hemodynamic force indeed requires tracing of the endocardial border, which today is still performed manually offline. The development of reliable tracking technique can speed up this phase and probably make possible a more modern view of heart failure that is not just a ejection fraction preserved or not preserved.
That's a great point. Alex, anything to add?
Yes. I think ejection fraction has its usefulness, especially depending on the degree of cardiac dysfunction. So it's an easy thing to detect and to measure. And then if you see major changes, then it's clear that you have, you know, big time systolic dysfunction, for example. Even untrained people, you know, just a little bit of training can acquire good images for the assessment of ejection fraction. But I agree with Dr. Pietro that it's a very crude parameter of cardiac function, and many others have been developed recently that are much better. The only problem is that they are very time-consuming, you know, to acquire good images. Some of them require that you have very pristine images to have very accurate assessment of the parameter that you're interested on. In my opinion, as you know, artificial intelligence are developed, and if they can be used in combination with those newer softwares, So if they can basically analyze the changes in the endocardium wall and cardium wall as well, then I think we could be translated into a much better and comprehensive assessment of cardiac function, both systolic and diastolic functions. Perhaps even we can see changes in regional portions of the heart that may be dysfunctional before others, which is very difficult to do today with the methods that we can easily use in the clinic.
Pietro, can you share any behind-the-scenes struggles?
Yes, I agree with Alexander that ejection fraction is easily to use the clinical setting with almost no training. When we move to more complex analyses that are not so easily translated to the clinician, can be used for research approach or to study the more subtle changes of the function, we have to consider another point. That is how the methodology can be reproducible, can be both by the same investigator or by different investigators. So intra-observer or inter-observer reproducibility, this is a matter of concern. In our small study, we investigated the intra-observer reproducibility over time. So the same observer tested, and according to our data, it seems reproducible in this particular setting. We have to see another case.
So the involvement of systolic or diastolic function is a controversial element in twin pregnancy. What are some ideas for why this occurs from a physiological standpoint? And, do we see this in other mammals?
Well, most studies in those areas are usually in rodents. So rodents is not a good model for twin pregnancy because usually they have, multi-fetuses. So they, in a sense, they do have a significant increase in in preload and volume in the heart. So in that sense, it could be a valid model, but that is a normal pregnancy in rodents, usually with many babies. And in large mammals, like cows, equines, and others, I'm not aware of very detailed studies on, on cardiac function. Because usually most investigators are interested in the well-being of the offspring, or of the mothers, more related to usually overall cardiovascular function in general, blood pressure, heart function, but not in details like we are discussing here, and also in metabolic dysfunction that may occur as well. But I'm not aware of very detailed studies on other large mammals.
Well, we can consider two points. One is that as for the controversy surrounding systolic function, this may be related to evaluation at different time points due to different observation protocols. Actually, systolic function seems to behave differently over time. So we have some phases when it changes and some phases when it normalizes. So it may depend on the phase. As regards diastolic function, to my knowledge, this is the first study evaluate diastolic dysfunction with presumed volume curves in humans. The second important point is strictly connected to human study, because when you assess rodents or experimental animals, you do not have the between subject difference, which absolutely characterize humans. In our study, we have to emphasized the finding that no comorbidities were present in women studies. So the weight was normal, no blood pressure changes, and other, no diabetes. This is not commonly observed in pregnancy. So unfortunately, I have to say. So these are the two main important differences.
Alex, I'm sure you have something to say about the comorbidities, so why don't you take something and take it away?
Yes, that's a very good point. And I think that is another very key highlight of this paper, this study, that I think it could be used as a guide of what normal is, normal adaptations to twin pregnancy, for example. And perhaps this could be extrapolated to pregnancies that are at risk. For example, what would be then the adaptations or lack of good adaptation that we see in this study in women that actually develop hypertension during pregnancy or that were already hypertensive and maybe have other metabolic disturbances? For example, obesity is a big deal nowadays. We have an epidemic of obesity, and we see, at least in our hands, that obese mothers, at least in rodents, that they do have change that you would not anticipate, you know, based on that degree of obesity, that's not very much. And we see marked change in their cardiac function. And we also see in change in cardiac function of their offspring very early on as well. I think that would be, you know, the next step for detection. So what if they, you know, using especially the method that was described by Pellegrino et al., I would guess that the hemodynamic forces are not going to change the way that they saw in their study with normal women. So that would be very key to perhaps as a sign early on of, you know, of the degree of change in the hemodynamic forces, that if that can predict the worse adaptation later on during the pregnancy.
Pietro, what are your next steps for you in this area of research? Have you begun to study a larger cohort yet?
The first point is the point that touched by Alexander, that twin pregnancy of women without risk factor are an ideal, but unfortunately infrequent experimental model. However, at this stage, our interest is also directed toward other conditions of physiological response to workload. And a parallel condition could be athletes. And how an athlete responds to volume.
Okay, I want to thank Pietro and Alex for joining us today. This paper was added to the call for papers that's recently closed, but a collection is on cardiovascular complications in pregnancy. So Pietro or Alex, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I wish to thank you for the possibility to talk with you, and I'm very happy for this.
Yeah, me too. I really appreciate the opportunity to participate in this discussion with this wonderful study in twin pregnancy. I really enjoyed talking to you all.
Thank you all.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the AJP Heart and Circ podcast. Our theme music was written and performed by Ray Mitchell. Catch the latest episodes of our podcast at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.